I believe that most of my subscribers know who you are, but if you could just touch on who Vinnie Eastwood is real quick.
I'm New Zealand's answer to 1984. A lot of people call me the Alex Jones of New Zealand, and I call Alex Jones the Vinnie Eastwood of America. It's basically like the truth movement's a very, very serious place, and not only do we need to understand all the serious topics and everything, but we need to figure out a way of releasing the tension of reality somehow, and that's kind of my role in the movement as a whole, is just to be here, have some fun, and keep people sane.
Dig it. All right. I was looking at here a while back at the freest countries in the world, and I believe that New Zealand was listed number one there.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was watching an interview you did about a year ago where you said it was pretty much about like America there.
It's pretty different in a lot of ways, but it's very similar in a lot of other ways. I mean, let's take, for example, our police aren't carrying around assault weapons all the time and pointing them at black people every chance they get. You know, that doesn't happen in New Zealand very often.
Right. Yeah, I think that in America they're kind of pushing for a, like a race war, maybe.
Yeah.
They really got something going on with that.
There's always something being brewed up or churned up anywhere, and to have somebody come out and say New Zealand's like the freest country in the world or whatever, to me it's kind of like saying who's the freest prisoner in a prison?
Yeah, yes, exactly. And it's like America, you know, the land of the free, home of the... I'm like, man, somebody's just living the illusion, man. There ain't no truth to that.
Yeah.
There is no freedom in America.
Well, we're the... No, there's plenty of freedoms in America. You can choose between Coke and Pepsi. You could choose between 500 channels of American Gladiators. You could choose to watch Rocky VI. You could choose to watch CNN and other garbage news. And those are the freedoms that you do have that are secured under the Constitution, you know.
Yes.
Article 1 of the Constitution. You're allowed freedom, but only if it's over trivial shit that doesn't matter.
Correct.
You know, thank you, America. It's okay, you know, because you're not alone in all of this. I mean, you've got fluoride, we got fluoride. You got chemtrails, we got chemtrails. You got GMO food being grown without people's permission and taking over people's farms for no absolutely reason, and then Monsanto basically comes in with armed people and takes over your farm regardless. Yeah, that happens here too. You're dumping poison into your water supplies? Oh yeah, we got that in spades. You've got, I don't know, urban planners or whatever who are getting you every single municipal council in the entire country into massive debt that they could never repay, except in the case of selling every single asset to the bankers. Yeah, we got that too. So we're not really that different. There's a different accent and different place names. But other than that, if you look at it just in a general kind of way, it's exactly the effing same.
Yeah. You know, I was looking at some video from New Zealand. Beautiful land there. Very beautiful country.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is that I've been looking at a lot of nature footage from America, you know, like the mesas and the mountains and the forests and all of that kind of stuff. And I think, my God, we've got all of that here.
Plus.
Yeah, pretty much. It's all kind of like locked in into a very, very small country with only 4 million people in it. So there's bugger all people around to corrupt the landscape. Which is, you know, I guess, okay. Somebody said yesterday, I think it was, that you could fit all 7 billion people on the planet in New Zealand, except you'd be pretty pressed for space.
Yeah. All right, let's see. Okay, over the years on your show, I mean, has it been, like, learning? I mean, like, you know, each year do you feel that you've learned more? You know what I'm saying?
Well, it's more like each day. If you look at the yearly cycle, you'll notice that I get more cynical and jaded as each year passes, like a real journalist. And it seems to me now that being informed about how the world really runs in the first place is sort of like a big wake-up call. But once you have that big wake-up call, you have to apply yourself to it. It's kind of like learning something like, hey, fluoride's bad for you, and then just keeping on drinking fluoridated water. Can't do that, unfortunately. So that's why learning about conspiracy stuff is one of the most frustrating undertakings that you will ever be put upon your existence, because it means that everything Fs you at every single time of the day, all the time. You know, it's pretty unfortunate.
Yes, in that other interview, you had said something that I had said in the past. It's like, once you find out that it's all a lie, it's hard to deal with. You know, it's like the music, the television, you know, the ways that they keep you like watching over here when you should be watching over there, you know. Once you see that most everything is a lie, it's just hard to deal with.
Well, it fills you full of hate, anger, rage, depression. It's basically the identical to the grieving process. What do they say? It's like denial, despair, depression, anger, and then acceptance, or something along those lines. And right. Yeah, it's precisely the same thing. I mean, the emotional trauma from knowing that your government isn't Big Daddy anymore and doesn't love you, and in fact wants to basically milk you dry until you die. It's not a very comforting thought, and which is really ironic, because there's a dude in New Zealand called Matthew Denteith who works at the Auckland University, and he's doing a thesis on conspiracy theorists and conspiracy theories. And his explanation, his analysis of why no conspiracy theory exists and is real, and why people believe them, is because he reckons conspiracy theorists need to feel comfortable with certainty about what's going on. And so they invent these things to be worried about. Now, I kind of get, like, are you retarded, man? Really? Bro? In what way is knowing that there's a bunch of ruthless, criminal, sociopathic, scumbaggery mother effers controlling the planet and my life and wanting to kill me and all my family and all my friends and all of my brothers and sisters of the human race and enslave the rest? Tell me. On what planet, that's a comfortable, reassuring thought?
Yeah.
It's not.
It isn't.
Okay? So, right. This is half the reason why I do my show, is because I'm not happy with it, and I know that a lot of other people have been severely damaged by these things that they've discovered. And so many times I'll bring on people that have really suffered immensely, and they'll come away from my show feeling different, like for the first time that they have in years, because this is the only time when they've actually been able to sit there, talk about how everything's pissing them off, and having a laugh and laugh their ass off about it. You know, it's necessary. It's medicine. I mean, just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. I mean, otherwise, what's the point of being killed?
Good point. Very good. But in fact, you know, I listened to your show every day when you was on American Freedom Radio. Every day. I love listening to your show, and I wish it was still on there.
You may, in fact, be in luck. Because yeah. American Freedom Radio will be coming back shortly. And I will most likely be returning to them on a regular basis. But watch this space. There's a lot of balls in the air at the moment. We don't know. We're trying to reset up the network or something. I'm not, you know, directly involved with its realignment. It's been off for like 18 months. So, yeah, it's going to be hopefully a good year.
I hope so. You know, I kind of got my doubts on 2015 for some reason. I think they might have the big one planned, but that's
all. I say that every year.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's kind of like the boy who cried wolf, you know? First two times he says there's a wolf, everybody rushes up and sees, and then the third time he just, nobody even cares anymore. But there really is a wolf. And it's that's sort of like why I don't predict things like, oh, there's going to be a financial collapse. Oh, there's going to be tyranny taking over. Or there's going to be this, that, or the other. I just go, we're screwed. And we might get slightly more screwed, you know? It's just the same old, same old. Just get used to it. Because I've figured out that the end of the world is a very stressful concept. Now, I discovered a while back that stress causes illness. So, if you're sitting there worrying about the end of the world and causing yourself a lot of stress, you'll then get infected with a lot more illness, which will quite likely kill you before the world ends.
Before the fluoride kills you.
Yeah. You know? It's not like, oh, don't take mitigating factors or ignore reality or anything. It's just more the fact that you've got to kind of get ripe with the doomsday plot, you know? Dance the apocalypto once in a while. You'll feel better.
I shall. Okay.
Especially if you have some maracas.
I do not have them. I have a guitar.
Oh, though. So that would make you miraculous.
Exactly. I'm without maraca. Okay, you'd said that, I guess what tipped you off originally was Alex Jones and his documentaries?
To a large degree, yeah. But it wasn't just him, actually. The very first inkling that I got, there was actually a, you know, a full-on conspiracy, and with any detail to understand it in full, was in 2004, where my friend showed me Michael C. Rupert's, what was it, The Truth and Lies of 9/11. And if you haven't seen Michael Rupert's stuff from thewilderness.com, I suggest you do. He's no longer with us anymore. He committed suicide. And he actually committed suicide. It wasn't one of those, oh, he committed quote-unquote suicide. He actually did. All his friends were knew that he'd been really depressed for a long time. It's pretty hard to... let me put this in context. What he did was he was working undercover narcotics, and he found out the CIA was shipping the drugs in. And he started to try and expose that, and instead of them going, oh, well, these guys are actually breaking the law, bringing the drugs in, let's bring them to justice, because he was awarded commendations from the Justice Department and everything, they just went, okay, what are you going to do about it, bro? We're the CIA. We'll shoot you. And they did. They shot at him several times. Threw him out of house and home. Messed his life up, something chronic. You'd be surprised how difficult it is to find yourself a partner, you know, if that's your lifestyle. Hi, I'm Heather. Hi, Heather, I'm Michael. Hey, what do you do for a living? Well, I get shot at by the CIA on a day-to-day basis and get harassed by phone calls and everything because I'm exposing their drug running operations. Oh, okay. It doesn't exactly get the juices flowing. And you know, the guy gets lonely, has to deal with friends, and like a lot of honourable, strong and intelligent men, doesn't ask for help. And that's the thing about it. You know, you take personal responsibility for an issue and you go out there, you expose it better than anybody, and instead of asking for help when you're down in the dumps, you kill yourself. And I think to myself, man, if only I'd been able to speak to him, you know. I tried to email him a number of times, wanting to get an interview. But I didn't. And he's gone. And I don't know. It seems to me that there's a lot of people in the truth movement that kind of pass on, and they've accomplished a lot in their lives, but you just wish they were still here, you know.
Like, yes.
Aaron Russo and...
I was going to bring him up.
Bob Chapman as well.
Yeah.
International forecaster. I remember I got the pleasure to interview Bob once when I was first starting out in radio, and I said to him, corruption, is it something that could actually be eliminated permanently, you know, so that you'd have like a corruption-free society? And he says, no, it's a perennial problem. You have to deal with it all the time. It never goes away. And you just have to remain vigilant the whole time. And I think that a lot of the times when I'm thinking about corruption, a little part of me just goes, hey, Vinny. You know, I'm like, yeah. Are you being corrupt as well, bro? I'm like, no. Oh, okay. Good on you. The reason I do that is because there's a philosophy called the Ballad of the Cosmic Schmuck. Have you ever heard this?
No.
Cosmic means big, schmuck means idiot. And the Ballad of the Cosmic Schmuck goes like this. If you're sitting there and you've never questioned your entire life whether or not you are the cosmic schmuck, then you probably are. But if every now and again you wonder to yourself, am I the cosmic schmuck? Then you're probably not, because you're questioning yourself. You're questioning your morals, your motives, that kind of thing on a rather consistent basis. This allows you to progress and sort of shirk off the natural human tendencies to, you know, hoard money and deceive people and that kind of thing. And I'm not 100% sure if it's an entirely natural human tendency or whether it's just a survival mechanism that's kind of popped up because we currently need to deceive, lie, cheat, and steal to a certain degree in order to survive nowadays, right? Whether you're cheating on your taxes, or whether you're lying to yourself or lying to your wife or something of this nature, society has been built up in such a way that those things are not only commonplace and acceptable, but they're almost entirely necessary, and you cannot get away with things without it. I mean, like, for example, a cop who's a trained liar comes up to you and says, do you have any marijuana on you? And you have marijuana. Do you tell him that you've got some? Or do you say, no, and I refuse to be searched as well? You see, the system forces you to be dishonest just so that you can live an honest life. Isn't that messed up?
It is messed up. I speak on it daily.
Yeah. And I was just thinking about this last night, how grateful I am for my life. I was thinking about a lot of things in my past, like, I don't know, girls that I tried to get with and they rejected me, or I did something stupid and scared them off or something like that. And I was like, I have a wife now. I don't even have to deal with that kind of worry again. And I thought about old flatmates and old crappy places that I used to live in, and I was like, I live in a house with my wife now in a reasonably quiet area, and we've got gardens growing that we've established and everything, and I don't have anybody cluttering up my space. I've got no job with an employer, so I've got nobody telling me what to do, and I don't have to do school or write BS essays about things that don't matter for grades that mean nothing. My life is really sweet. Almost all the big problems that had been phasing me my entire existence are now actually kind of solved. You know?
Yeah.
I don't want people bossing me around. Don't want people in my face or in my space. And I don't want to have to do stupid things that don't matter. And I've managed to eliminate, over time, all of those elements from my life. And I'm happy. I just realized it last night. You know, it's actually quite strange. Yeah, it's quite strange when you're looking up at the stars and you go, oh my God, I'm actually happy. How the hell did that happen? You know, you're sitting there, you're talking about conspiracy and scumbaggery all day long, and it makes you forget that you're actually happy because there's so many problems going on.
Yeah, that's kind of it. You know, my friends feel that same way about me. You know, it's like, you know, maybe you should just get over the fact that they're taking freedom. You know, maybe you should just, you know, I'm a farmer. You know, it's not, I don't know. It just bothers me that nobody else sees it, really. You know, nobody else really kind of picks up on that, you know.
Well,
they're taking it all away.
Sometimes when we get isolated, we start to feel that loneliness, as if we're the voice in the wilderness. And it's simply about your social circles. Like, one of the other elements I forgot to mention was that I don't have any friends that I don't actually get along with really well about and are able to converse with on things that really matter. I don't have any friends that call me names or ridicule me or do any of that stuff. You know, as soon as they start, block, and the scum is gone. They're not my friends. And unfortunately, when it comes to real life, though, real life, you need human contact. Facebook friends are not enough. And unfortunately, you most likely be at a time or a point or a period in your life where you don't actually have any real friends. And the fact is, you don't really feel like you've got a choice because you've known them for so long and you know, that kind of thing. I don't know what to do about that, because it's really, really difficult for truthers to make friends, because A1, only about 1% of the population can actually knows what you're talking about and might be able to get along with you. And two, the other 99% of people that you talk about it will freak out and you know, run away. And it's becomes very isolating. And it seems to me that it's a lot about what happens to people who go into prolonged isolation, how they come out and they don't know how to talk to people properly anymore. Like, they lose their social graces, etc. And you see this a lot on truthers with Facebook pages and YouTube comment sections and things like that. It appears to me that as if half the people who have awoken to even a portion of the truth have been driven nuts by it. And I think that's because they've lost their sense of humor about it, and they don't have an emotional defense bracket around them. They don't have friends and family that are understanding to their new realizations. And this was similar for me when I first started out. My family weren't very weren't very encouraging. Let's just put it that way. But now they've kind of just sort of come to accept it, because I realized at a pretty early stage that every time I started talking about conspiracy among them, I'd get crap for it, and it wasn't worth it, and they weren't ready to listen anyway. And so I started to try and figure out, how do I relate to these people when nothing they're into actually interests me anymore? You know, they're talking about TV shows and all sorts of things that don't matter at all, and probably never will in the context of history. How do you get along with people like that, that you'd have no common interest with? And I had to force myself to remember what were the conversations and things we used to get along with before I knew how the world worked. And it turns out that we told lots of jokes, lots of stories, played cards, board games, had nice meals together, and talked about how our relationships and our lives were going. And so I forced myself to reevaluate my behavior around them, because normally I was getting really angry and upset, you know, because when you're talking about things that are true and people think they're crazy, it makes you angry, and then the anger makes you go crazy. You see how that works?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just kind of like remembering who you used to be and how you used to get along with them, and then basically restoring that faith and just showing them that you are who you are still. You haven't gone nuts. You're still capable of having an ordinary conversation. And then they learn to accept you again. And then they stop calling you crazy. And then they start sending you links to things that they've started reading about things that you'd normally read and tell them about. You see how that works?
Yes, I did. You know, I got a friend, and it was probably just over a year ago. I was talking to him, and I could tell by the look in his eye, because, I mean, I had just met him, you know. I mean, he was a friend of a friend of mine. And I could tell by the way he was looking at me, it was like, this guy's mad, man. He's, you know, he thought, but shortly thereafter, I mean, he just started kind of, you know, he was listening, and then started telling me what he was seeing. And it kind of led him straight up to where, you know, I was at. It, you know, it depends on who you're talking to, I guess. you know.
Well, we often get into that trap, and you said, well, you're talking about that before, how nobody understands, no one gets this or anything. It's not true. It's something that your mind tells you is true because you don't see any evidence to the contrary. But it's kind of like air or wind. It's invisible. It's not there. But you can see its effect. Yeah?
Yeah.
And the thing is, when you're trying to socialize with people, it's very, very difficult. So what I found is much easier for me, at least, is meeting new people who are listeners of my show, going around to their houses, hanging out with them, and having a few laughs and whatnot, and occasionally they'll click. So the thing is, like, you can use Facebook in order to supplement your social diet, as it were, but I find that it's so much better used as a means of actually connecting with real people on a real basis. You know, you send somebody a Facebook message, hey, bro, do you want to meet up? Do you want to have a coffee or a beer or some other form of social stimulant? And you wind up making better friends that way because you're taking the guesswork out of it. If you go into bars and nightclubs and all of that sort of stuff that you may have used to do back in the day when you were a yurt, it seems sort of pick and mix, hit and miss, isn't it? You know, you may yep. or you may not find somebody that you get along with. You may or may not find somebody who represents your view on reality and that kind of thing. And my priority has always actually been to befriend people who are better than me at something. So, like, my best mate, Mikhail, he's a way better guitarist than I am. In fact, I can't play guitar at all. he's a better photographer than I am. My mate Jono is better at selling stuff than I am, and managing his own finances. He appears to be almost as good at maintaining his relationship with his woman than I am. That's why he was my best man, because the whole idea of a best man is so that if you've got problems in your relationship, you've got somebody you can go to help you through with those problems, who's actually better at their relationship than you are. And my friend John Eisen, he edits Uncensored magazine and the New Zealand Journal of Natural Medicine. Very knowledgeable guy, is connected with people all over the world. I kind of consider him to be, you know, partly mentoring me to a degree. And the thing is, what was it? I remember I took a screenshot out of a documentary I watched recently called Rich Man's Trick. Have you seen Rich Man's Trick yet?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. It's so good, man. Like, wow. I was... When you're this many years into it, and when you've got millions of people who know your name, as is happening to me at this point, you kind of get this sort of great humbleness when somebody can show you a documentary that actually informs you better, right? Like,
yeah.
You get so informed that becoming more informed becomes a rarity rather than just clicking on to the next thing or the next article. And a lot of life, especially, basically, the more cynical you are, the more likely your assumptions are to be correct. Or at least that's what I've found. And, it's about paying umbrage, really, to those who've come before you, because they've actually dispensed all this knowledge. And they're the very reason why you have any at all to give or to share with others. You know, it's kind of like a waterfall effect. It starts from only one drop of water, but look what comes from it. And in this documentary, Rich Man's Trick, they have this quote at the end of it, which I thought is quite fitting. And I've sort of used the context of this quote a number of times beforehand. And it says, to those who have come before us, we are like dwarfs sitting on the shoulders of giants. We see more and things that are more distant than they did. Not because our sight is superior or because we are taller than they, but because they raise us up and by their great stature add to ours. That was by John of Salisbury in 1159.
Wow.
You know? And I'm just kind of thinking about this. Aaron Russo comes to mind, like, massively, G. Edward Griffin and Jordan Maxwell. A lot of these older guys who are really at the forefront, or like were at the forefront decades upon decades ago, and have provided a lot of the openings for people to learn about the way the world really works. Now, I wonder, though, when it comes to spirituality, what you learn and don't apply to your life is simply knowledge, and it doesn't become spiritual knowledge, right?
Yes.
And it occurs to me that if you're trying to change the world, you know, everybody says, oh, you got to first change yourself. And I say, well, yeah, I guess that's true. But the other element is not aiming way, way, way too high. Like, as a truther, you get burdened with this responsibility. You know that there's problems with the world. You know that there's ruthless criminal psychopaths with more money than God and the intel community, etc. It's too big a problem for one person. And yet, you go out initially going, I'm going to solve this. I'm going to teach people that 9/11 was an inside job. I've got truth. I've got facts. I've got evidence. And then you realize, in short succession, if you're smart enough and don't and aren't a fan of beating your head against a brick wall, that facts, evidence, and truth are not enough. They're not, are they?
No.
It doesn't matter if you've got irrefutable facts, concrete evidence, even admissions of guilt. It doesn't matter, because you're not dealing with a populace that knows the difference between a fact and a lie. Okay? They don't know the difference between distortion and clarity. I mean, they think technocrat is some kind of a DJ. There's so many mistruths and misinformation, disinformation out there, that it's kind of confused and kerfuddled, discombobulated even, the entire populace into not even possessing the ability to discern truth from facts anymore. Not only that, they don't even want to.
No, they don't. Most of my friends and family, they will go out in the next election and vote. And every time I say, the people that you are voting for are already owned and bought. They will not represent you. It's a waste of time.
Yeah.
But they'll go do it. They feel that, you know, it's what they should do. They should go vote for the, you know, the right polished turd every time.
Yeah. Well, so they understand the reality then that they're polished, that what their choices really are, aren't they?
Well, I mean, I would hope, but I don't think that they really do. I mean, I know in the last election, I was like, please, man, I mean, who would you go vote for and why? You know, I mean, they're both just criminal.
Yeah. See, in the New Zealand election, I voted, but I voted for... In fact, before I describe voting in the New Zealand election, I'll tell you how our parliaments differ, eh?
Okay. Yeah.
You guys have got like the Senate, the Executive, and the Congress. Yeah, we've just got Parliament. That's it. It's basically just one big Congress with the Senate and the Executive all mushed together. There's no separation of the powers or anything of that nature. And the Prime Minister, who's the equivalent of the President, has basically dictatorial power. So he appoints anybody he wants, whether they're elected or unelected, from his party to be his cabinet members. And his cabinet members can do, they basically control those elements for which their job description is entitled. And they also possess the power of quote-unquote parliamentary urgency, which means if they want a law passed in the next 5 minutes, they can, and they force people to do it.
It's going down like that in America.
Yeah.
Executive order, you know, they can just do what they want.
See? And our current Prime Minister, John Key, used to work for the Federal Reserve and Bank of New York for 2 years in charge of the derivatives trade in Europe. He was elected in 2008 for a blue party on a campaign platform of change, and in his first term of service to the people, borrowed more money from the bankers than all previous prime ministers in New Zealand's history combined. Does this sound familiar?
It does. A lot.
I mean, these things are... I mean, remember when we started off this conversation talking about the similarities between New Zealand and America? That's it right there. It's the same group of scumbags running the show, and they've just got separate henchmen, okay? I don't know if you ever played with G.I. Joes as a kid or something like that.
Of course.
Yeah, everybody's got their favorite G.I. Joe, and they bring him out, and then, and that's basically all it is. Bunch of kids with a shockingly large amount of money, completely out of their minds, drunk on power, playing with their favorite G.I. Joes. The problem is millions of people die every year as a result of their little games. And I don't know about you, but it's become almost a war of attrition on the mind to sit here and know this. Kind of like the burden of having a conscience is that you can't sleep at night. And I think that's one of the interesting elements that you can tell the difference between a normal human being and a psychopath, is because a psychopath goes to sleep out like a light. Not lying awake thinking about nothing. All right? They go straight to sleep. It's because they don't have the burden of a conscience. They don't have the same aversion to things that you and I do. Like, let's say, have you got any enemies? Just a yes or no question. People you really, really don't like? I do.
Not really, really, no. I mean, you know, there's always those, but not really anybody I would like, you know, enemy-wise, you know, nothing like that.
Yeah, but I'm sure you have had in the past.
Oh, sure.
You had stoushes with people, and basically your whole concept is either to get them the hell out of your life or to destroy them and make them leave your life. Basically, the end result is the same. That's what you want. You don't want to associate with these people anymore, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, there's two types of people in this world. Those who want to be left alone and those who won't leave you alone. How do you exactly do you fight somebody like that? Okay, somebody who's got no rules. Let's say if you or I were enemies with somebody, would we consider killing their children to teach them a lesson? No, we wouldn't, because we've got rules, morality, things of that nature. Psychopaths don't have that kind of thing. The only rule is whatever they can get away with. And depending on how crazy a psychopath they are, sometimes that won't even matter either. There's only two things they fear: being exposed to the light of day and being shown for who they really are, and worse, psychopaths. Now, have you seen the film The Chronicles of Riddick?
With
Vin Diesel.
Vin Diesel, yes, I have. It's been a while back. I did watch that.
All right, so context of the film is this big evil army conquering worlds of the universe, that kind of thing. And there's nobody that's strong enough to oppose him, except another kind of evil. And that's what I'm kind of searching for now, is a good bad guy. Somebody who's completely psychopathic, ruthless, dyed-in-the-wool killer, who knows how bad he is, doesn't feel emotion, doesn't have a conscience, but actually knows on an intellectual level that he's bad, doesn't deserve life, and probably has no real practical use or benefit to all of mankind, and is willing to sacrifice himself, not out of a moral obligation, but just out of a, you know, I think this is probably the best thing to do, bugger it, I don't really care anymore, and go and do something to these bad, bad, bad people who are really running the globe. The problem is I don't see that kind of motivation coming out of a creature like a psychopath, because they only crave money, power, and control. And you don't get more money, power, and control than killing the money powers who have all the control. You do it by working for them. This is why bad guys don't get assassinated, because only a good guy would want to see them get killed. And good guys just don't assassinate people.
That's a good point.
It's unfortunate, isn't it?
I mean, it is. Sort of, but not, you know.
I don't know.
What would any good guy out there killing people?
How many good guys out there assassinate people?
I can't name any.
Yeah, see? And, you know, you go to any crowd in the United States, any hall, any great public speaking platform, and you say, okay, raise your hand if you think you're a reasonably decent person who wants to protect the innocent and chart a better future for the children of tomorrow. Everybody will put their hands up. Now, how many of you are assassins that would be willing to kill the evil people that are stopping that from happening? Not a single hand goes up. And so, it continues, doesn't it?
Yes.
And I really don't like this whole line of thought that you have to kill somebody in order to solve a problem. I mean, look what happened in Russia. Lenin and these guys, they killed the Tsar and his entire family, the girls too. And what happened to Russia? Did they become any more free? No, they actually got worse enslaved, and they became a massive military dictatorship, and they confiscated food from the Ukraine and starved 7 million people to death in the streets. Not exactly the kind of solution you want. The black nobility and the Rockefellers and Rothschild families and what have you, they're basically what happens when a society decides that it's no longer brave enough to clean off the dead wood and allows the rot to continue through the whole tree of life. And I'm reminded of when, what was his name? You know that general, Smedley Butler, General Smedley Butler, the most highly decorated soldier in United States history, even to date. He was hired by the banksters in the 1930s to lead a fascist revolution, a coup. And then he knew that they would basically take him out if he refused, because he already knew too much. So he played along until he got all the information, everything he needed, in order to find all the people who were financing it. And these were the DuPont family, Rothschilds and Rockefellers, J.P. Morgan Chase, Warburgs, these kind of people. These were the tip-top of the cream of the crop of America. And they had 500,000 troops ready to die on the altar of fascism in order to overthrow their own nation, which gave birth to them. And so Smedley Butler went to FDR and said to him what was going on. And Mr. Roosevelt looked over this list of all of these names, of all the owners of the most major corporations in US history, the biggest section of the economy that you could really conceive of. And he knew that if all of those CEOs and all of those families that owned all of those assets were sent to jail for treason, that the stock market would plunge and it would destroy the country. So he did nothing. And later on, this criminal cabal killed John F. Kennedy, who just a month before his assassination had signed into law Presidential Directive 11110 and 11111, which were to abolish the Federal Reserve, which was owned by 13 private parties of the banking cartel, so they could issue money out of nothing, and decide to replace that with a red-backed currency, which was debt-free. And he also decided to abolish the CIA, who was shipping the drugs in. Pop. That's what happens. And I remember interviewing Alan Watt, and he was telling me about how little hope he has, because he knows and has studied for many decades the exact methodology of these people to corrupt, co-opt, and if necessary, eliminate people and movements that are having an effect, a real effect, at dislodging their power. I don't know how to overthrow that. Me as one guy with a radio show and a YouTube channel,
I'm not capable of competing toe-to-toe with the mainstream media. Sure, they're losing listeners every single day, and I'm gaining listeners every single day. Sure, I'm in my fifth year now of talk radio, 8 years in total of full-time activism, and haven't been employed that whole time, and have been able to subsist on the voluntary contributions of listeners who aren't paying me to do anything. They're simply giving something to me so that I can survive because of what I've already done. And I don't know if the effect that I'm having is absolute, but I feel that I have a moral obligation to simply play my part. It's not a problem that's big enough for any one man to solve. Any one man who thinks he can solve it has probably got delusions of ganja, or he's an agent. In fact, that's a great saying. When he calls somebody who smoked too much weed and then thinks too highly of themselves, delusions of ganja.
You know, I had heard you say on the other one that you was arrested for marijuana.
Yeah. Back in the day, back in 2004. But I've been selling... Yep,
same year I got arrested, same thing.
Oh, no. Were you selling weed, or...?
No. I just had it. They lowered it to possession of 30-plus grams. Still did 6 months in the big house.
Oh, my God.
And it was first offense, and I was kind of taken back by that. I was like, you know, there's something really wrong here when, you know... That was 10, well, almost 11 years ago, but...
It's still with you every day, isn't it?
Anytime
when you think about it as well, like when I try to think back, it produces a physical response. Okay, so the heart remembers, the mind remembers, the body remembers that pain, that trauma, that suffering, that stress. And it doesn't forget. You know, it's kind of like a soldier who learns to clean and take apart a rifle blindfolded or something like that. You can still remember it. And I was caught with 13 grams, and I was going to go to jail for up to 8 years for a first offense. Luckily, though, when I gave them my full confession, they hadn't advised me of my right to remain silent. And so my lawyer got my confession struck from the record. So 13 grams without any previous convictions. I got 300 hours community service. And the kid in front of me was growing 5 cannabis plants, was charged with sexual assault and resisting arrest. And this wasn't his first offense. And he got 150 hours community service.
What?
And the guy in front of him just got out of rehab and didn't have any money, and so he stole a jar of Craig's raspberry jam from the local BP service station, and BP prosecuted him, and the judge awarded them damage of $4.26 to replace the jar of Craig's jam that he stole. It was, you know, you're just sitting there and you're like, not only is court boring, not only does it destroy people's lives, but it's just very expensive. Okay? It's boring, it destroys people's lives, and it's very expensive.
There's no justice either.
Well, I'm sure there is justice at some point, you know, somewhere, you know. Somebody's actually done something wrong, and they get punished for it. That'd be nice. I mean, I was arguing with a guy this morning on Facebook about judicial corruption and how there's very, very little people who are getting arrested for it. And so he shows me a couple of articles of judges and lawyers that have, in fact, been arrested, charged on perjury, corruption, crime, and things of that nature. And I'm looking at these people, and I'm like, none of them are the elite, right? These people are worth less than $50 million. They're not part of the secret society clique. They haven't done enough payoffs, basically. That's kind of how cynical my mind has become, is that I can't accept that the justice system delivers justice. I can't accept that the legislative process delivers real legislation. I can't accept the official line on anything anymore. I just can't. It's part of my two base principle assumptions of life. Number one, if it comes from an official source and there's an official story, it's probably the direct opposite of what they're telling you it is. And number two, if you can make it, if you can eat it, but you can't make it in your own kitchen with ingredients that you can find, then it's a soft kill bioweapon.
Yep.
Now, these assumptions may not appear very rosy, but unfortunately, they're quite accurate a lot of the time. And it seems to me that people who are within the system are those who are the least likely to be able to see it. You know? You ever seen that?
You know,
it's like, you're too close to this. If somebody's like, for example, a lawyer, and you try to tell them that there's a huge amount of corrupt judges in New Zealand, for example, they go, no, because they're a member of the Bar Association. It's basically their bloodline. If they don't have respect from the Bar Association, they don't have a career. And so they spent 7 years of sleep deprivation and repetition, which are incidentally mind control techniques, by the way, learning how to be a lawyer, and have nothing to show for it. You know, that was apart from $100,000 worth of debt or something of that nature. You see what I'm saying?
I do.
These people are time invested, emotionally invested, and intellectually invested in their career. And their career is at a hierarchical structure. Okay? Now, what happens to hierarchical structures traditionally throughout history? They get infiltrated. And as the old saying goes, if you don't have people to stir the pot, just like stew, a layer of scum builds up on the top. And I think this is what we're dealing with now. A layer of scum at the very top of every single hierarchy on Earth. If it has a hierarchical structure, it's been infiltrated, it's currently controlled. That's basically my broad brush assumption. Now, somebody will say, oh, but I work for that organization, I'm not corrupt or anything. Do you control the entire organization? Well, no, I don't. Then how the F would you know? Have you worked at KFC before? Yeah. When did they tell you the secret recipe? Well, they didn't. Well, that's because you don't own the company, you frickin' idiot. They don't share the secrets with you your first day on the job. I mean, what planet are you living on? Do you think criminals and mafia bosses just come out like at a press conference and say, by the way, we control Hollywood? No! They don't do that, you nitwit. That's the reason why people don't know about it, is because, A, it's frickin' concealed, and two, they deny it when it's exposed. And a denial is all people need to hear in order to completely dismiss it. Isn't that interesting? It's because they don't want to believe that the institution that they place their faith in is corrupt. Okay? Even the New Zealand Prime Minister, John Key, who was given evidence that the New Zealand judiciary is extremely corrupt, said that we are not going to touch judicial corruption under my watch, because it'll mean people have less faith in the judiciary.
That's insane.
It is. All right, and it's kind of like, people sit around, they go, well, how could he have said that? That doesn't make any sense. It can't be true. And I say, well, just because it doesn't make sense doesn't mean it's not true. Okay? That's the problem with writing fiction, Mark Twain said, is that everything in the fictional novel has to make sense. If you're writing non-fiction, it doesn't have to make sense at all. It just has to be a fact. And when things don't make sense, in my opinion, that's because somebody is full of crap. And they're trying to confuse the situation so that they can get themselves out of a little trap. You know? They don't want to be exposed. They don't want to have all their powers taken away from them, their wealth, etc. I can understand that. I mean, I want wealth, personally. I want a little bit of power, personally. I want to be able to do a few things with my time. I want to be able to travel when and where I need to,
if I want to go to a conference in the UK or something like that, I don't want to have to like save for 2 years in order to save up a couple of $1,000 just in order to pay for the ticket. I want to be able to just grab my bag, make the internet booking, and just go. I want to have just a reasonably comfortable existence, you know, just water, air, food, and a roof, and high-speed internet. I don't really need anything terribly fancy with that, same as a car. But other than that, I mean, I'd say in order for me to have absolutely everything I wanted, it would be maybe between $60,000 and $80,000 a year. That's like all my dreams come true kind of thing. Because it's like Forrest Gump said, there's only so much money a man really needs and all the rest is just for show.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very, very true. I got given a big wad of inheritance at one point, and I just sat there for ages just going, oh, what could I spend it on? What could I spend it on? And I realized that I didn't actually feel like spending it on anything. There was nothing I wanted. There was nothing I needed. And I don't know why that is. It was actually kind of like the strangest sensation, because I've been pinching pennies for so long in my life to being an activist that I don't know how to be foolhardy with cash anymore. You know, I used, like when I was a salesman, I was earning, you know, several hundred bucks a night for only a couple of hours work, calling out people doing telemarketing, you know, and selling about maybe one out of every two people that picked up the phone, I'd managed to sell them. I was pretty damn good, and got plenty of coin, and I did like going out and partying and spending $100 and just buying beers at bars and that kind of thing. But now I don't have that kind of motivation anymore. I mean, what I'm more interested in is actually enjoying my time and enjoying the people that I'm around. And I found that money isn't necessary for either of those things. Survival, on the other hand, money is absolutely necessary at this point in time. I need to purchase food because we don't have a water filter. I have to purchase water as well. At big 20-litre cans that we get from the organic shop. And it just seems to me that the cost of living just keeps escalating, right? So in order for somebody to be comfortable, they have to be basically wealthy, right? That's kind of what I'm starting to realize now, is that there really isn't really much of a choice for the broke-ass mofos out there who can't afford to even live. And now the United States, along with New Zealand, are making it illegal to help homeless people.
Yeah.
If you give food or money to homeless people, you can be arrested. Cost them like, I don't know how much it costs per hour to pay a cop, but the concept of arresting a person for having compassion and helping out a fellow human being, to say that is a crime,
is criminal.
It's evil, man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Some acts are criminal, some are evil. And I've started to believe in evil because I've started to believe that I'm good. And what I found about being good is what defines you is how much you're willing to sacrifice in order to vanquish evil. How much are you willing to give up? And I know that this is an immutable truth because I've gone up against psychopaths before, a number of them. Each one of them, I have managed to derail to a degree, but with a great cost to myself, to my own state of mind, to my career. But it is the mark of a good man to know how much he's willing to sacrifice in order to back up his beliefs with actions, I think. But I never encourage people to go engage with psychopaths because I know that, again, as I said before, they don't play by rules and they will mess up your life. Something big and bad and chronic.
And it's just so hard, man, because I know lots of people who are currently going through this. Like, there's a friend of mine, Chris Wardell, who's got a case down south now where a policeman was using a police iPhone to film a teenage girl in a shower. And he got granted name suppression. And so my friend Chris breached the name suppression order and told everybody who this guy was, and then they arrested him.
So, yeah, it's like filming a cop. You know, you can go to jail for that, really? You know, and the guy's supposed to be doing his, like, you know, his job by the law. You know, why would they have a problem with being filmed, you know?
Yeah. I did that to a cop one time, actually. I said, you don't have anything to hide, do you? He didn't like that. Because he obviously did have something to hide.
And the Almost first... do.
Oh, yeah. Oh, dude, you got to see the video that I made when I was protesting out Pukekohe. Was it Vinnie Eastwood forced to stop protesting or something? I'll send you the link after the show.
Okay.
But I was accosted by a cop after megaphoning for about 10 minutes. And then actually got to talk to the cop for a good 20 minutes. So twice as long as I was protesting, that was how long I talked to the police officer for. And I had a really good conversation with him, actually. I mean, he's just doing his job. But I was better at my job than he was at his. I.e., my job as a douchebag with a microphone is to be charming, smooth, and really, really kind of enchanting. And I was. I was damn good. I was answering every question. I was making poignant statements. I got him to laugh. Actually ended the stoush amicably and behaved honorably and with respect. In so doing, not only did I manage to convince the cop not to take any of the other people that were there's details, like the people who are helping me do this protest, you know, holding the megaphone up and the signs and so on and so forth. I took personal responsibility for all their actions as well as my own. I gave the cop my details. I mean, you're supposed to not do that. But the thing is, when you don't do that, you piss the cop off something chronic most of the time and they just arrest you unlawfully. Whereas I find that if you just answer questions fully and calmly and act real charming about it, they don't arrest you. They just take a few notes and then take them away. And for me, with my experiences with police, any excuse to not have them arrest you is an excuse I'm willing to make. Okay? It was extremely traumatic when I got arrested. Never again. Never again. And it's not like I'm one of those criminals who goes, oh, I'm never going to get arrested. I'm going to go out and commit crimes and things like that and just get away with it. I just don't commit crimes. And if I'm around cops and I've done something, you know, slightly illegal, I don't know, like I've gone speeding over the speed limit or anything, it's yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir. It's kind of like... I've had this pathological honesty my whole life, you know, and I don't know. It's either gotten me into trouble or it's gotten me out of trouble. You know what I'm saying?
I do indeed. That's kind of right up my alley.
Mm.
About the same way.
Because it's like, you know, sometimes people are understanding and they're blown back. They're taken aback by how honest you are and think, man, this guy isn't such a bad guy. There's not really a whole point in punishing him. Just give him a warning and send him on his way. You know, I mean, there was this one time, it was a funny story, actually. I used to look after these autistic boys part-time. And one of them, his dad was a cop. And I had some good conversations with him. And they were sort of truthers themselves, he and his wife. And their boy was severely, severely autistic. No ability to vocally communicate or anything like that. It just basically, they have to deal with it every single day. I was starting to go a little bit nuts because twice a week I was going around there to take care of their boy. And it was really starting to hurt me in my mind kind of thing. So I really applaud the strength of parents who have severely autistic children and the amount of effort it must take to actually learn how to deal with it. I don't know how they do. Maybe they close themselves off somehow because it's so traumatic to know that your child's like that. And it was New Year's Eve, and I think it was a couple of years back, and we were in town. A friend of mine invited me to a big party that they were having at the top of a building, a backpackers in town. And we left and went into Myers Park, which is in the central of the city. Nobody was around, and we just broke out the joints, broke out a few drinks, and just sat there in the park, you know, merrily minding our own business. And three cops walked down the hill towards us. And we were like, far out, no, it's a liquor ban, it's New Year's Eve, and we've got weed. Oh my God, no, not again, not again. And one of the cops says, oh, hey, Vinny. And I was like, who the hell is that? Okay, and it was the cop that I was looking after his autistic son for. And he goes, no, 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 guys, these boys are all right, just let him go. I was like, oh my God. I took that as a sign from God to keep smoking weed.
Sign from God. Keep on going.
I mean, go ahead.
I was going to ask, I didn't really want to change it, but you know, if you had any thoughts on the low oil prices, Russia, BRICS nations?
I haven't really studied up on it. I don't keep up with the news, actually. However, I have been talking about peak oil recently. And my question to all the environmentalists who incidentally push world government, Agenda 21, global warming, climate change, carbon tax on all human activity, reduction of the population, and basically a global communist tyrannical system under the UN, which Security Council has the UK, USA, Russia, China, and France, who are all, incidentally, the world's biggest arms manufacturers. So who better to have on the Security Council than the world's biggest arms manufacturers and sellers? You know, what could possibly go wrong? But anyway, peak oil. Okay, I saw this book one time, and it said peak oil is going to be so bad that we're going to run out of oil completely by 1991. Okay, what was the date on this? It was like a 1977 textbook or something like that.
Right.
1991 came. Nope. And then the oil price dropped sharply back in 2008 during the New Zealand 2008 election. And I asked the ACT Party leader, who became the Minister of Local Government, Rodney Hyde, how exactly can the price come down? Right. If peak oil's real, and it's already a scarce resource that is getting even more scarce and even harder to extract and is in higher demand than ever before, and we're using more oil than ever before, how can the price come down? Okay? Unless it's manipulated. Right? Peak oil's a myth. It's a freaking myth. So that the oil robber barons, who are incidentally the same people as the robber barons, because the same finance companies and everything running the whole damn show, know that oil is basically the elixir of life. If you look around in any direction, you will see everything surrounding you is made with oil. Okay? Or made with machines that were powered by oil. Have you got a desk? Yep. Have you got a chair? Yep. Have you got a modem? Have you got cables? Have you got a computer? Have you got DVDs or a television set or a house that was built or anything that was made or manufactured in any way, shape, or form? Have you got toothpaste, a toothbrush? Have you got plates, knives, cups, spoons, whatever? They're all made with oil or made using machines that used oil to run them. Okay? So if you want to control all human activity, as much as humanly possible, what resource do you go out and try and control first?
Oil.
Mm-hmm. And then secondly, if you want to control all human activity, what element do you tax?
Gas.
No.
Oh.
You tax carbon dioxide.
Oh, the carbon tax. Got you.
Because guess what produces carbon dioxide? Your exhaust pipe.
Oh.
And I was
gonna say breathing, but yeah.
Well, and breathing and everything else. You cannot name a single human activity that doesn't produce a greenhouse gas. All right. So, if you want to tax something, remember, taxing is the power to destroy. If you want to tax something and you want to control all human activity, you tax carbon. And that's it. Whole world stitched up. You have all the funding you need, all the control over all human activity. That's what the elite want. It's what they've wanted for thousands of years. Goodness knows if they've actually been around that long. Personally, I think the more modern iteration of the scumbaggery agenda against planet Earth and our fellow humans is probably since the Battle of Waterloo, when Mayor Amschel Rothschild took control of the English stock market and bought the Bank of England, and has ever since then controlled commerce, more or less, all around the world. And Britannia's holdings, the sun has not set on them. let's just put it like that. We're still living in the British Empire. Or the oligarchical empire. Whatever you really want to call it. In fact, it almost gets a bit redundant. Like a truth or cliche. Right? You ever heard of truth or cliche? You know, you tell somebody a piece of information or something and they go, oh, I think that's disinfo.
Yeah.
Yeah, all the that's funny.
The thing there with Russia, I mean, you know, a petrodollar, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I think that OPEC, being pretty much under the petrodollar, had joined forces with America to overproduce. Now, in America, they're saying that's hurting energy. But on the flip side of that, the BRICS nations are being put in a real hurt. Now, I mean, normally I listen to like AMTV, Christopher Green, Gregory Manarino. And last week they was really, really big on that. They said that probably a war between America and Russia will result. In fact, Gorbachev even said it could basically start a nuclear war in Europe. Yeah, that's why I brought it up. I kind of figured that was something that you had heard about.
But, you know, it's just, again, same old, same old. You know, surprise? Anyone? Anyone? No?
No.
I'm never
surprised.
Yeah. Oh, wait. Two big power blocks are fighting off against each other about whose new world order is going to be put in place instead of the other ones? Now, actually, there's another question I wanted to sort of relay. Because I've been studying this, like, I'm pretty staunch anti-communist, right? And I don't like the idea of socialists telling me how to run my life. However, I don't like right-wingers either to a large degree because they prioritize personal responsibility. And in a lot of cases, not all cases, mind you, in fact, maybe even a minority, use the fact that they have personal responsibility to absolve themselves of any social responsibility.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. And the reverse is true of socialists. Some of them, maybe not all of them, might even be a minority again, where they use their social conscience instead of their personal conscience, their own conscience, and they stop thinking. And it seems to me that there's a war going on between these two ideologies, a very real war. And I'm not 100% sure what the parameters of it are. So what I've understood is that there is the traditional communist manifesto kind of thing, which is basically New World Order to a T. And then there are socialist programs and things of that nature, which run counterpoint to the New World Order sort of thing, you know, like equality and having people with minimum wage and social welfare and things of that nature. However, if you look into any of these instances, there's something wrong with them. And every single communist state that has ever been set up has basically been a tyranny. All right, a tyranny is not a place where everybody's oppressed. A tyranny is a place where only people who resist get oppressed. And most of the people who don't resist, who just accept their conditions, go, hey, there's nothing wrong with our country. I'm fine. I've got my V8. I fill it up with gas every day. I can afford it. I get pizza and ice cream. I get to watch daytime soap TV shows. There's nothing wrong with society. And of course, if you're not looking at what the hell is going on in society, you'll never know. All right, so unless you're one of the people who's currently starving to death, you don't care, do you? Not really. No. Not anywhere near as much as that person who's actually starving does, I can tell you that much. Some people will say, like, oh, I work for Oxfam. I help the hungry. And I go, okay, did you have breakfast today? Yeah. You already had lunch, have you? Yeah. You planning on having dinner later? Yeah. Well, then you're three times luckier than any person you support to support. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like almost as if to try and do the right thing makes you a bad person. I mean, have you ever noticed that? Like I'll go out and I'll do the radio show and stuff, and then I'll ask people for donations to get me some new equipment so I can make a documentary as I'm trying to make at the moment. And people will criticize me and say that I'm a bad person because I'm asking them to voluntarily give me money for something that will help humanity. And that makes me the bad guy, right? Obviously. Right. Because if you're doing right by humanity, the last thing you should ever do is survive. You know, heaven forbid, you're trying to help humanity and you're not dead? How dare you? You know? You're eating and you're drinking water and you're not sleeping under a freaking bridge or wearing filthy clothing. You must be an agent. Freaking assholes. I mean, it's basically like people who've done nothing with their lives. And this is the kind of socialist mentality that you get around. You know, a whole bunch of people who come up to you and they never met you before in their life. They can't do what you can do. And they proceed to tell you how to live your life. That, in and of itself, is the mentality of socialism. It's you living in daddy's house. You get to borrow daddy's car. You get to have the food out of the fridge. But you have to do the dishes when daddy tells you. And if he tells you you can't borrow the car that day, you can't. You don't really have any freedom, any real, tangible, personal freedom. And on the other side of it, we have the right-wingers. Now, I was speaking to a number of them recently, and some of them criticize me because I go and I cover a lot of left-wing protests. And I say to them, well, that's because it's only left-wingers that protest. Right-wingers don't protest. They either solve the problem themselves, or they don't bother. You know? You ever noticed that? And they said, yeah, that's absolutely true. And so when it comes down to it, being left-wing appears to me to be about the collective, and being right-wing appears to me to be about the individual. And these are the things that cannot be broken. These are the most precious possession and prize of these ideologies. Now, how they're applied, on the other hand, socialism collectively takes everybody's freedoms away, and libertarianism maybe is not pure, or whatever they're saying or purporting that right-wing is these days, seems to simply take away people's rights to privacy and people's economic freedoms on a step-by-step basis until everybody winds up slaves. And so, patently, there's no difference between left and right-wing ideology in terms of how they're applied and in terms of the historical context. There's no freaking difference. That's why you can elect Clinton and he'll invade Kosovo. And then you elect Bush and he invades Iraq and Afghanistan. Right? There's right. no freaking difference. They'll do the exact same thing the military-industrial complex tells them to do. Now, that's the left and right wing as we understand it in the West, with this false dichotomy, because we're not choosing libertarian socialism, are we? Now, no. I wouldn't have much of a problem with that if people were living in a society where you voluntarily contributed taxation. Like if you had a checklist and you say, okay, every year on the financial tax return year, you get sent a one-page checklist by the government that says how much percentage of do you want to pay in tax this year in terms of charitable contributions, and which are the areas of government expenditure you want to contribute to. So you've got a checklist there. Okay, military defense, interest on foreign debt, medicine, the legal system, police, fire departments, roading, you know, these very, very simple things. Now, I think that that would put effective control of the purse strings into the hands of the people, and the government then would have to do precisely what the people tell them to do every single year, as opposed to we get elected and then we do anything we want. If you've got checks and balances between elections, that's why I don't think that protesting is one of those effective tools of checks and balances. It doesn't freaking work. I have yet to go to a protest where the thing that they're protesting about either stopped completely and never came back, or stopped at all. Right? Maybe I've been to hundreds of protests, and I've seen but one success story, and it was only temporary, and that was no mining New Zealand. Okay, 50,000 people in the streets of Auckland. This is the biggest protest I've ever seen. In fact, maybe the biggest protest in the country's history. Like, by a long shot. And the government went, ooh, that's not good. Okay, let's not mine the country. Until 6 months later when everybody's forgotten that they went out and protested for.
Yeah.
And then they open it up, boom! And then everybody goes, oh, we're really upset. And then they protest again, but only 1,000 people come out this time.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. I see how that works.
It's you envelope pushing.
Yeah, it's one of those things. What they want to do, they're going to do. If you stand up and try, you know, it just won't happen because in due time, like you say, they'll do it anyway.
Yeah, and I don't understand why there's still a war on between Russia and America. You know, allegedly the Cold War ended. It didn't end, okay? There's still a Cold War going on. I don't know exactly who the clearly defined factions are anymore. I think it's just a war on us. And
I mean that's kind of my take on it. Russia, America, Europe, you know, I think almost every country combined, the people running those are fully under the control of the PICs, the people in charge, you know, the people at the top. Yeah. And they take orders accordingly. You know, I don't think that there's much difference between Putin and Obama. They probably get together, have tea, and discuss how to screw the peasant better, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, you've ever heard the term Russian oligarch?
I have.
Okay. Have you heard of Rothschild banker?
I have.
Okay. Two sides of the same coin. What do you want? A country that's lovingly administered by Rothschild criminal bankers or Russian oligarchs? See, something tells me that we're not given much of a choice here, are we?
No, they're pretty much identical in a way.
Yeah. Muhammad Ali comes up to you and he says, do you want me to give you a left jab or a right hook? Yeah, I kind of don't want you to hit me at all, bro, because you're the best there ever was. You know, it's unfortunate. In fact, I'm feeling really depressed about this all of a sudden. Aren't you? Oh God. Man.
I'm depressed all the time. I never sleep. Yeah. It goes out of conscience, right?
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Yeah. I would like to sleep. I'd like to be that, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what. Go hanging out with psychopaths, all right? Become one of them. You can. They can infect you. And then you'll be able to sleep without a conscience. And the problem is you won't be able to love anymore. You won't have any creativity left either. These things that define us as human beings, the unique gifts that we have of compassion and creativity, aren't possessed by these clowns. And that's why they hate us so much. I don't know what it is about being human that makes me think constantly about how flawed I am, but I think more about how flawed other people are. Usually as a distraction against my own flaws. You know what I'm saying?
I very much do, yes.
Yeah, and truthers are really like this a lot of the time. They always talk about the general public and call them sheeple or sheep or whatever. And this is inherently disrespectful, I think. And it doesn't show the full picture, which is why I call the general public slave scum. Because I'm slave scum.
Do you mind if I use that term here and there?
Go for your life, son.
Oh, thank you.
And just because I think that other people are slave scum doesn't mean I'm in the dark about it. I know that I, too, am a slave. They'd be like, oh, but Vinny, you do a radio show, you do all of this kind of stuff. Yeah, but I'm still paying taxes. I'm still paying rent. I'm still living hand to mouth. I'm still working day in, day out. I may not be working for somebody else individually, but I'm working for the collective good of humanity on my own dime, on my own time, in my own way, of my own volition. But that doesn't mean that I'm free. Freedom's a state of mind first, and it becomes a reality second after you will it into existence. And again, this is the unique power that we have as human beings. You're capable of conceiving something that doesn't exist. All right? You got an idea in your head. Whether that be a documentary or a device, a piece of technology that you're inventing, or a painting. These things don't exist in the 3D realm yet. So how much effect do they have on the people around you if they don't exist yet in the 3D realm? Nothing at all. If you have a thought that is expressed down on paper, it's far more effective at affecting other people around you than a thought that you keep in your head and never say to anybody. It's not like you just put it out through the ether or whatever. And this is the problem with the New Age movement I found, is that they've missed that disconnect. They think that perception is reality, but they've missed half of the truth there. Perception is not reality, okay? Perception is only half of it. Action is the other half of it. And reaction, so to speak. If you think about something, and then you will it into existence, then it permeates and it starts to affect things in this real realm that which we live, we call the 3D universe. And not only will it affect other people within the 3D universe, it'll also inspire things out of them, a lot of the time, in their own minds, that don't currently exist in the 3D universe, that they can then manifest. See what I'm saying? And so, if you've got creativity, you have an obligation to fulfill its promise. For if you're sitting there with creative ideas and you're not creating anything, you are wasting your time on this earth. You are subverting yourself. You're stopping the flow of energy. There's something very, very important about this, and I wish more people would get it. That you don't need somebody to mentor you. You don't need somebody to help you. You don't really need anything apart from your own will, most of the time, in order to get things accomplished that are of importance and value. And people forget that. They think that because they're not an expert, that it actually helps them, okay? Like me, for example, a lot of people accuse me of being unprofessional, you know? I had this chick at a dance party a few years back. She asked me what program I use to make my videos on. And I say, oh, I use iMovie. And she goes, oh my God, you don't know what you're talking about. And I go, excuse me, how many videos have you made? And she goes, oh, well, I was part of the crew for two unsuccessful short films. And I go, really? Two projects? And you weren't even the head honcho on them. I've made 700 videos. And I have more subscribers than the largest newspaper circulating in the country. So with all due respect, you don't know what you're talking about. All right. And now, today, I've got 2,955 videos. More than that, even. Nearly 3,000. Another 20, 30 or videos or so. And I'm not talking about, like, they're like 2 minutes of me sitting in front of the computer rambling about some crap that I did that day. I'm talking about, like, hour and a half long videos. You know, 2-hour radio shows with the ads cut out and things of that nature. This is a huge amount of content that I've put on the web. Literally thousands upon thousands of hours of things for people to listen to watch, and to learn. I've got 17,500 subscribers. The closest competitor in the New Zealand news circuit that has a YouTube channel is the New Zealand Herald. This Herald has been around since, I think, 1865 or something like that. And they've got less than 10,000 subscribers. So me, by my effing self, have managed to outrank the oldest news organization in the country on this one particular playing field. That's me by myself. And the same goes for the blogosphere and all of these other things. The alternative media are starting to steal all of the audience. Because let's face it, the stuff that we talk about is a hell of a lot more interesting.
I agree.
A lot more interesting than sport, in the least.
I'll give you that.
Speaking of which, Super Bowl Sunday coming up soon, isn't it?
Don't even go on there. Look, my beloved Colts lost last night. Horribly.
Who did they lose to?
New England Patriots. Again, every year we got to go there to play. By one game, we lose every year. They go. Colts stay home. It's ugly.
Yeah. And you think about this. Now, does it mean something of significance to you and your region of the country? Does it actually make a difference to people's lives if they win or lose?
Not really.
Okay, so how much time investment, money investment, emotional and intellectual investment is there in the game?
Probably quite not much, except for like vendors. That's it.
Yeah. Okay, so basically you get no return for your investment.
No.
Okay. Now, I was talking to a couple of guys about cricket. Now, I don't know if you know much about the game of cricket, but they play games that last weeks, all right? They call it test cricket. These guys throwing balls around and batting them around a field for days and days and days and days and days. And I thought to myself, what a freaking waste of time. How long did you spend watching that game there? Oh, I went there for the whole day, mate. It was great. It was a full 9 hours of cricket. 9 hours of cricket? Dude, I once cut together two, like, whole slideshow presentations with, like, two camera angles and three different speakers in about the same time frame about fluoride and inform people radically about something that affects their health that the authorities are lying about. Now, I think that's a better time investment on my part, and I didn't do that with the help of 80,000 other people or whatever, who were listening on the radio, watching on the TV, and there in person, all group participating in another group team of people for something that has zero real importance, zero real practical significance at all.
right? It's basically just entertainment. Now, if people were to react the same way about movies, television, and things of that nature, and they do, they follow these things, and they think that because they're following it, that they're a part of it.
Yes.
But the problem is, you're not part of it. Okay? Most people will never be a part of the movie-making industry. Most people will never be on TV. Most people will never play sports professionally. Most people will only ever be spectators. And for some reason, they're happy with that. They're happy with observing people that are doing more than them in a particular field, in some cases quite literally, accomplishing nothing for humanity. They're actually sitting there, literally, watching somebody accomplish nothing for hours on end. See, that's my mentality when I look about it. I don't follow sports at all.
But
this doesn't mean that I say that you can't enjoy it, all right? Like, I watch movies instead. That's my form of entertainment, all right? Now, somebody could easily point the magnifying glass back at me and say, hey, Vinny, how many hours are you sitting there, you're watching these movies and you're expanding these plots and things of that nature? What did you accomplish while you're doing that? And most of the time I'll say, well, I took a couple of screenshots of a Masonic floor and all-seeing eye pyramid for a documentary that I'm making about Freemason symbolism in Hollywood, and took a couple of audio recordings from an inspiring speech during the movie, or one where they mention Order Out of Chaos, again for the same documentary about Freemason symbolism in Hollywood that I might be making later on. So I've kind of gotten to the point in my life where I can't switch off entirely anymore. Even when I'm trying to sit down and be entertained, I'm still looking for conspiratorial crap. It's exhausting.
That's exactly where I am. I haven't really had a TV in 7 years. It's because I just kind of refuse to watch it. You know, I see it's a programming, you know, that the shows, they lead your mind to think a certain way. And the same applies with movies. You know, movies since back when have just gotten worse and worse, in my opinion. And, you know, it's all about how they lead you to think, you know. And when I do watch a movie, like at a friend's house, that's what I'm looking at all the time, to look at the little subtle references that they give and symbology and such like that that's right there, because they feed it to us full time in about everything that we see, watch. If programming wasn't entertaining, it would be very poor programming, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that they call it programming. The CIA figured out that mind control is addictive. So you're sitting there...
I believe it.
You're sitting there watching the TV being mind controlled, and then somebody turns it off. You're like, what? Dad, you turned off my mind control. I hate you. I hate you, and I love it.
I have friends that live right down the road from me, and all they do is watch movies. You know, that's it. Whenever they're home, they got a movie on. They send the kids to their room with the movie. And I'm like, people, that's bad, man. You know, I don't know. And I mean, I ain't pointing a finger at movies or people that watch movies, but it's a form of mind control. Mm-hmm. You know, it just really is. No different than the television, music. About anything.
Yeah. And there's no protection from it either. It's like, for example, I will say two words. Large breasts. Nothing can stop that image from getting popped into your mind once it's mentioned. Pink elephants. Same thing. And when people tell me that, oh, I go to see a movie, but no, I don't get mind controlled from it. Really?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I watch movies, and I'm cognizant of the mind control of them. But the thing is, I'm only looking for about maybe 15 different elements of mind control in any given film that I'm looking for. I'm looking for ancient Egyptian symbolism. I'm looking for the words order and chaos. I'm looking for a whole bunch of different things, conspiratorial elements, socialized, you know, basically movies are more or less just an allegory for reality to a large degree, because again, as Mark Twain said, fiction has to make sense. And often what's hidden in films, I wouldn't say especially, because it's kind of random. But what I found in films is that they kind of tell you what the elite are doing to a degree. For instance, and I think this is probably one of the best films of 2014, was Captain America, The Winter Soldier. And this film really stood out for me, primarily because of the plot. Now, so spoiler alert for anybody listening, the plot is this. S.H.I.E.L.D., which is Marvel's version of the NSA, has been co-opted by Nazis that they took during Operation Paperclip, and they actually refer to Operation Paperclip in the film, and they create a digital algorithm that is capable of locating any person anywhere on the planet and look through all of their bank records, all of their digital footprints, and determine whether or not they are a threat to this Nazi organization, either now or based on their case histories in the future, they might be a threat. And they launched these, and they're planning to launch these helicarriers, which have precision guns mounted on the bottom of them that can eliminate 1,000 people per minute. And they are planning to launch these things into the atmosphere, load the algorithm, locate every single person on Earth that could ever cause harm to them or their Nazi operations, and kill them all. And forever control Earth with a gun pointed to its head 24 hours a day. That sound familiar to you? Certainly
it
sound freaking
like what's going on.
Sounds incredibly familiar to me, doesn't it? Now, yeah. I was wondering, because this film I watched recently called Rich Man's Trick, by the way, if you haven't seen this, Michael, you know, or anyone else, just go see it. It's so damn good. Rich Man's Trick. Rich Man's Trick. Sweet mercy. It's 3.5 hours long, bro, and it's worth every second. I was like, oh my god, like after a few years in the truther industry, you kind of get sick of watching documentaries, because I was watching two or three of them per day for the first 6 months. My knowledge leapt forward at a geometric rate. I became 10 times the man I was in such a short period of time. This documentary by itself did that much for my wake up process, as that whole 6 months of knowledge that I'd accumulated when I first got into this jazz. All right, like, it's unbelievably good, very well researched. In fact, it's not sensational. That's the really funny thing about it. It's so real, and it's done by a historian who actually provides all the names, dates, places, absolutely everything that you need in order to figure out what's going on and how they did it. So extraordinary was the detail that it actually had a physical effect on my body. I came away from watching it feeling high, really high, like brain overload kind of thing. And this is why I personally am into filmmaking and doing radio and all of that kind of stuff, because I know that there's no possibility that I could actually talk to somebody off the top of my head and get all those ideas and all those points and all that facts and all of that kind of stuff down. So my ability to explain things to people is fairly limited. But in the context of a recorded conversation or a prefabricated film script and things of that nature, there's so many elements that you can manipulate and change in order to actually help people get an idea better. And I think that's one of the most great things about movie making, especially when the movies are made to inspire people. And that was kind of the thing about Captain America for me, is I found it truly a source of inspiration. Because you think about the elements of the character, honor, sacrifice, duty, loyalty. These are the elements that I think define good men, and elements that are sadly missing in a lot of today's men. Because they're dangerous. People like that with principles are very difficult to push around. And even when you do start pushing them around, they're very difficult to push over because they push back. And these kind of lessons, I think, are very important, particularly for the young people, because it's the young people who are going to wind up going away and fighting all the wars and everything like that, and they need to be the ones to actually stand up and just go, no, sorry, bro, I'm not going to go over and die for your money. There's right. just no way. Now, can we, you know, sit down one day and have a talk with the elite and just say, hey, bro, would you mind, you know, not enslaving and exterminating everybody? You know, just a just a little request there. And, and they'll be like, oh, nah, she's right, we'll just keep going on.
I think that there is a depopulation about. I think that once they get it to a level, it'll be different. You know, I mean, I think once that they, you know, after the big one, you know, I think once they reduce the population down to where they wanted a controlled population, I think that all of their technologies will probably be given over. You know, it will become the new fundamental, you know, like life extension, stuff like this, you know, for the masses that are left. But in that meantime, you know, there, if you look at the world's population, they got to feed them. They got to, you know, there's a lot balanced on that. But once they reduce that population, you know, then what? I mean, I'm sure that they got technologies that are like far in advance of anything that we know. Vinny.
Yeah, I agree. Although I don't think they're really going to release them, though. I mean, it's like people with a conscience would, you know. Tesla, for example, he wanted to give people alternating current, but what did, what was it, JP Morgan, I think, electrocuted an elephant during a massive, like, stage around, surrounded by people, and really freaked them out. And said that this is why it was so dangerous for Nikola Tesla's alternating current, which we use for pretty much everything today. It made the radio and all bunches of other things, and a lot of things aren't credited to him. And he wasn't really interested in the money, per se. He just wanted to sit there, invent his stuff, and put it out, and maybe improve humanity a little. But he was, you know, pretty cautious. He warned people about the dangers of his technologies, like his heart machine, for example. He said he could tune it to such a point where it could split the earth in half. A lot of people believed him. And so they built one and tried to split the earth in half. and just use it as a weapon. You know? That's the thing about inventions, is that to the man with a conscience, his invention can help people. But to the man without one, it can be retooled and weaponized, right? Like, right. I've been talking to these guys, the Thunder and Light team, who've created embedded holograms, which they claim affect environments. So you can put one of these holograms on your window, for example, and it sends out a resonating frequency that balances out the temperature. So it'll either prevent heat from escaping through the glass if it's cold inside, or it'll prevent heat from coming through it if it's hot inside. And so naturally it balances this out either way, or at least this is what they claim. And he was talking about these other methodologies by which you can use these technologies that were basically just weapons. You know, you can kill people with my technology, he said. You can do really irrevocable damage. You can mind control people with it. His intention is just to help people, help them better, cleaner environments and things of that nature, healthier minds, healthier bodies. But he does know that they can be easily changed around and used for nefarious purposes. And this is why I'm suspicious of myself a lot of the time. Because I think about how can what I do be used for the exact opposite purpose?
How could it?
Yeah, well, I figured it like this. Like all human beings, I'm corruptible.
Okay, so anybody says, I'm incorruptible. You're not Batman, bro. Trust me. You can be corrupted. Whether by threats, whether by payoffs, whether by, you know, there's a number of different ways that have been used over time to corrupt people. And it's usually, the most popular method is telling you what you want to hear and promising you everything you want. And psychopaths will do this all the time. I've had so many offers from people offering to give me millions of dollars if when their gold mine sells or something like this, and or offering me a movie deal or something like that. And, you know, the way I'm dealing with it now is you're either going to give it to me, whatever you want to give it to me, without expecting anything back, or we're not really going to be doing business, bro. Okay? Because I'm doing my own thing. Now, if you're watching what I'm doing, and you like what I'm doing, and you want to support me, then effing support me. Don't come in and try to control me, co-opt me, corrupt me, or change what I'm doing. If you've got a better idea, sure, I'll listen to it. If it's not practical, if it doesn't work, then it's not. Then there's no point. What I really hate is people coming and telling me what I should be doing, what I should be covering, what topics I should be covering, etc. When 99% of the time, the topic that they mention, I have covered.
That okay. happened.
You know?
Remember, I think it was about a year and a half ago, I had emailed you and I said, you know, the guests that you got on, you know, why don't you get these guys? And you said, I've already got those guys on. You know? Hey, I didn't even hear that. I didn't even know that they were on your show.
Yeah, yeah. and my show's not very well catalogued. I mean, like, I've had to do all the webmastering myself, all the audio editing. I've had to pay all the bills. I've had to do all the videoing, all the editing associated with that, do all my own producing, all my own guests, all my own emails, all my own Facebook. Everything that you see of Vinnie Eastwood online, unless I'm on somebody else's show, has basically been my work, you know, entirely. In and of itself, nobody else can really take credit for it. But that doesn't mean I'm like so great and so fabulous and wonderful and like really good at doing all this stuff and so much better than everybody else. I mean, despite my narcissistic flair, I've also got a great humbleness about me to a degree. Sometimes, because mostly I fear my own head getting to me. You know, when you get too full of yourself, you become you get too far ahead of yourself. You know what I'm saying? And almost every time where I've claimed something, like I remember I was at a conference about pills that have been given to children that make them commit suicide and or kill their parents or both, and one guy recognized me and somehow got into a conversation where I said that I have pretty much an opinion on anything. And so naturally he mentions something about brain emulsification or some crap. Or I didn't know what it was. So I said, well, I don't know what it is. Just tell me what it is then. And so I can express an opinion on it. And he goes, no. And it was just like, bro, you were just being a dick. You know? And it's just kind of like, sometimes the best gift that you can have is being utterly humiliated when you think you're awesome. Bring you down to earth. And I've said this on radio a number of times, but a lot of my friends are activists. They expose scumbaggery for a living. You know, it's their job. They watch the corrupt. They know their methodologies. They know how to expose them. And they know how to bring them to justice. And the reason why I'm friends with these people is because I fear my own propensity towards corruption, just like any other man. And I surround myself with these people for that exact express purpose. Where if heaven forbid, I become some form of douchebag, they will expose me and dethrone me so that I can't continue to do damage to the minds of people. Now, this is the reason why I'm also a one-man operation, because it makes me impossible to infiltrate. I have a feeling, though, that there's this level of success that I may wish to achieve. So, for instance, I'd like to have, I don't know, like I said before, 60,000 to 80,000 bucks a year after tax, so that I can travel and live relatively comfortably while I spend every waking hour exposing scumbaggery, all right, in the service of humanity. I think that'd be a reasonable wage or salary to draw from. By no means an incredible salary. Many people, I could be probably earning twice that easily by now if the last 8 years I had spent selling bullshit to people for money. Unfortunately, though, I had an awakening, and I realized that that was not my path, and it was not the right thing to do. And here I am. I'm broke, but millions of people know who I am. And some people's lives have been changed and improved because of my life decision. I mean, my producer, I think in my first year of doing the Vinnie Eastwood show in 2010, got an email from a listener who was having a real trouble with her husband and her family. And she was getting really sad about it, and she was going to commit suicide. And then she started listening to the Vinnie Eastwood show, The Lighter Side of Genocide. And she started laughing again for the first time in a long time. And she decided, because of listening to my show, that life was worth living, actually, and decided to live. Now, for every one person who that happened to, there must have been more. So whatever I'm doing, even if I'm not accumulating power and resources to myself in a personal basis, there's other people who are being benefited by my work that aren't me. And I don't know these people. May, for all intents and purposes, never meet them. May never know how I've helped them. But that's not the reason why I do it. I don't do it because I want to accumulate something for myself. And I'm not doing it because, oh, it helps so many people. I'm simply doing it because I have a moral obligation to, and I don't feel that I have a choice. We must resist tyranny. We must expose scumbaggery. We must help the innocent. We must attempt to relieve the ignorant of the burden of their stupidity. We must enlighten people. And it's because of my moral stand that I've achieved all I've achieved. I couldn't have achieved this if I was being paid. And in fact, earlier in my time, I probably would have refused to be paid in order to do it and say, no, it's all about the freedom, it's all about the freedom. But ultimately, you can't expect people to spend their entire lives doing something for nothing. Okay? Plenty of people, you know, they do some form of charity with their life or whatever, and they don't expect anything back. But that's because they've got a full-time job, as well as doing one day a week of voluntary work on the weekends or something of that nature, helping people out in a bit of their spare time. Whereas me, I had a paycheck of $4,000 cash after tax and $11,900 worth of shopping vouchers for Westfield Malls here in New Zealand. And so I quit my job and I became a full-time activist just like that. It was the biggest paycheck I've ever received. And ever since then, I have been working full-time for humanity's sake. And to think how different life would be had I not done that. I kind of think that I've not missed out on anything. Really. I didn't like any of the people that I worked with. I got along with some of them, but there was ultimately nothing there. It was shallow. It was meaningless. And I've dealt with shallow and meaningless people all my life, and I got sick of it. And now the only people that I talk to actually matter, you know? They talk about things that are of great importance to the human journey. And to do anything less with your time is a disservice to yourself and a disservice to humanity. And I want to thank you, Michael, for letting me come on your show today, bro.
Hey, it was a pleasure having you. And, you know, for a first one, you know, thank you. You know what? I'm glad you were, like, I've spoken, because it was almost like listening to the Vinnie Eastwood show.
Yeah.
It was a whole lot like that. Before it ends, could you tell people how to donate to your cause?
Well, if you're in New Zealand, you go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news. And you just scroll down a little bit, and there's either a PayPal there, so you can whip out the credit card and you can send us some coin there. I like it when people do the automatic payments. So if you sign up and you put in like $5-$10 a month, I have some listeners that do $40, $50, $100 a month automatic payments to support me, and it's only really by the contributions to me by so many different diverse people of backgrounds and various levels of financial security that I've been able to do pretty much any of the work that I've been able to. And also there's a, if you are in New Zealand, there's the Kiwi Bank bank account number there for V-Man Companies Limited. And you can start up an automatic payment into there. And of course, once offs, I'm not going to complain either. And at the moment, I'm trying to raise money to get a new computer for my documentary that I'm making. It's a pretty multifaceted documentary. It's, you remember how we started off this conversation, Michael, where it's comparing the different things about America and New Zealand and how they're actually kind of really similar?
Yes.
I'm going to be basically making a documentary about that.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Great.
Yeah, full length. So if anybody wants to support that, I, you know, please. I've been doing this for quite a few years now, and just keep getting bigger and better. Millions and millions of people have seen my YouTube videos, listened to my radio shows, not only just on my platforms, but I encourage people to download and re-upload their favorite archives and things all over the place. If you search Vinnie Eastwood, there's like hundreds of thousands of results that come up now, and I've only just turned 30, like in the last 20 days. So I'm trying to accomplish as much as I can in as short a life as I've got, because I'm 6'4", and as far as I know, it's the short people that live long lives. So, you know, kind of like Achilles, you've got to accomplish a hell of a lot in the short time that you can before somebody snaps an arrow into your heel.
Well, I appreciate you being here and doing the interview. Again, that's it. That is Vinnie Eastwood, everyone. There you go. Hang on a second, Vinnie.